I am a human being and I killed human beings.
Before I knew it, I'd fired 4 shots at the door. I kept on shouting for Reva to phone the police.
Tests are underway to determine if a serial killer is on the loose in Centurion, Pretoria.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
In a country marked by the harsh reality of 84 daily murders, these are the stories that echo through the reality of life in South Africa. Hello, it's Paul Llewellyn, and I'm delving into the minds of Africa's most evil. What drives them to commit unspeakable acts? What does it take to bring them to justice? Leading the way on our journey is Jared Labuschagne, an author, former law enforcement officer, and current head of LNS Threat Management. Labuschagne helmed the investigative psychology section of the South African Police Service from 2001 to 2016, working on over 300 cases of serial murder and rape. An internationally recognized and renowned expert in forensic psychology, he is simply known as our Profiler. Don't forget to get along and get your hands on Profiler Diaries 1 and Profiler Diaries 2, both great reads. Please spread the word about the show. Share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone interested in crime in Africa. You can visit us at YouTube. Just simply search Profiler Africa, and you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. Just search Profiler Africa. Also on Instagram at Profiler Africa, and you can join our Facebook group or drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. And we will, you know, we post stuff on the social media pages when we have it and what have you, so that as we're discussing the cases, you can take a look at some of the things we discuss where we have the relevant content. 84 people murdered every day. Just to put that in perspective, that's 5.5 Columbines every day in South Africa. Are we angry enough? I don't know. What do you think, Jared?
I think we have just become quite used to it, really. And also, I think a sense of like, how can this change, and what's going to change it? So
more than a Sharpeville every day.
I mean, every few months the quarterly crime stats come out, and there's a little hoo-ha. This is the murder rate, and it's fizzled down by 3 days later. I mean, they came out, I think, last Friday, and next news story.
Exactly. Moving on. Now today's case. As we explore, I mean, we've done a lot of historical cases from stretching back over the last 30 or so years. And hopefully we'll delve a little bit deeper back than that. I mean, I've been reading the book that you sent me. It's basically, what's it called again? I forgot the name.
Boberg Story, B-O-B-E-R-G, Boberg Story, which is the name of the author.
If you can get your hands on Boberg Story, recommend that you do. Boberg was a detective in the South African police, what, back in the 40s and 50s?
I think he started in the 30s, I think he was already, and then he became the head of the detectives for whatever we were back then. I think we were called the Republic of South Africa. And I think he resigned in the 50s and wrote his memoirs. So kind of like my books, but just, you know, as fascinating. And as I always said, that's probably the most fascinating South African true crime story, because it just tells of detective operating in those days before we had all the fancy stuff, and how... Absolutely. There's some core principles that even till today, a good detective has, no matter what forensic tools you have available to you. If you don't have those core principles, you're never going to be a good detective. And how he solved crimes, and it's like ingenious. Mm. And I've always said I'd love to see this put into a documentary series or a dramatized series. And it's really a phenomenal book. And you can only get it, I mean, it's out of print. As I said, it was last printed, I think, in the 50s. So you can find it here and there at like specialist bookstores. Get yourself a copy. It's available English and Afrikaans. It's just the most amazing book to read.
Well, I mean, I definitely think once I'm through it, we must delve into some of the cases in there and maybe do a couple of episodes on it. I wonder if there's any colleagues of his or anyone from that era that kind of remembers him well. It would be interesting to explore that. We must do a little bit of our research.
Yeah, I mean, that's 70 years ago when he resigned. So even if you were 20 years old, a new detective, you'd be 90. So, I mean, it's not impossible.
No.
But
unlikely.
Yeah, I don't think you're.
Well, anyway, we'll explore more about that story. Now, today's case, we're going to be talking about a guy who became known as the Seersucht Monster, born in 1995 in Boksburg, Gauteng, to parents who were not married. They were both drug addicts. They couldn't take care of him. They gave him over to his grandmother when he was 17 months old. And then he was moved on to his aunt from there, who cared for him. A disruptive start to life, as is often the case with people who tend to turn out to have issues. He would refer to himself as a charming psychopath and a smart serial killer. Now, I know that you're fascinated by this case, Jared, but as far as I understand, he only killed one person. So why is he referring to himself as a smart serial killer?
So, again, this was a case that I'd never heard of. I think it's probably one of the most fascinating recent cases in South African history that I hadn't heard of. And whether it's just because I tend not to read a lot of local media because it can be a bit depressing, or because the fact he was caught immediately, this wasn't a long, drawn-out investigation, this, that. He was literally caught red-handed, as you'll see in a moment or two. That often kind of quells the media hype about it. Until we fast forward, and of course, as the police then start to uncover more information that's really fascinating, that's not necessarily getting into the newspaper until we go to trial, which in this case was about 2 or 3 years later. Mm. But fascinating because it includes some, you know, for me, diaries that he had written, which I've had the privilege of having looked at. The process leading up to the murder, where he was sort of stalking various victims, gathering intelligence about them, and he wrote in his diary that he's a sort of a charming psychopath, a serial killer, he's fascinated by serial killers. So we get these insights that, A, you just often don't get in South Africa. You know, if you watched serial murder movies, you think all these serial murderers have these very elaborate, well-written out fantasies and described, you know, that they've been developing for years in detail and it's written about in diaries. The reality is you don't often see that. They might be there in the guy's head. He might never want to tell it to you. But we don't often really get that proof of it. And here we start through the investigation, a very good investigation that was done. Even if you catch someone red-handed, you still have a lot of investigation work to do. People often think that's the end of it. Mm. And we start to uncover the diaries. You know, he's interviewed by people as time goes on at Falkenberg, etc. And we get all this information about what was he thinking prior to the murder. And that's where this turns from becoming just a guy who went and killed someone to actually, in my opinion, a serial murderer who was caught after his first one because he just wasn't particularly good. But he would have continued further on. And of course, that became a big issue. Then it's sentencing. So we're going to touch on all those various aspects where this becomes quite fascinating. And besides copies of the diaries, you know, we've got in front of us, you know, a report from Falkenberg where he was sent twice. We'll discuss that. And of course, I've seen a report from one of my colleagues from my old unit, the investigative psychology section, the Western Cape branch, that also assessed him and interviewed him and wrote reports. We've got some really nice insights and details about the backstory.
All right. So before we get into the details of the case, I'd just like to talk about some contextual stuff just to pick your psychology brain a little bit and get your thoughts. We talk about Reiter here acquiring a fascination for this kind of thing, for murder and committing crime at a younger age. What is it about people? I mean, we also see just generally in the world that crime is a very popular mainstream kind of genre these days. Lots of people are into crime content, a 70% female sway on crime content, mm-hmm. typically, which is interesting as well. What is our fascination with? I mean, he's taken it to the extreme, but we all have this morbid curiosity about this stuff, or a lot of us seem to.
Yeah, I mean, everybody listening to this and you and I talking about it, all of a fascination, healthy fascination, I'd like to hope to think. I think, again, if I speak myself, it's, you know, as a psychologist, I'm fascinated by human behavior. And this is just such an extreme form. Crime is an extreme form of human behavior, specifically the types of crimes that we talk about on this podcast. Mm. So I think that's just this, why? You know, why do people do this? And I think it's like horror films. It's a way of getting close to the topic safely, to listen to a podcast, to read a book, to watch a movie. It gives you a bit of exposure, but in a safe way. Your curiosity, hopefully, to some degree, is answered. And you know, if you think about it, as a species, that humans are violent. If you look at from the point where we became, I don't know, Homo sapiens millions of years ago, till now, and you put it in the timeline, it's only the past little tiny sliver of that timeline, literally a tiny sliver, where we've been quote-unquote civilized. So maybe it's part of our DNA to have this, in a way, it's like this violence in us. Like I said, we haven't yet been domesticated. Yeah. So maybe some way this is the modern way of satisfying that bloodlust, or maybe Freud would call it, you know, the sort of destructive id type of urges.
How do we itch that scratch today, though? What if, you know, I mean, is violence is as natural a part of human existence as lovemaking.
Well, I think there's various ways. I think like this, reading about it, watching it safely. I think there, that's, you know, sports. I think sports to some degree replaces that old type of violent competition. Literally, you know, from MMA, but even, you know, sort of normal Olympic sports. I don't know if that's the wrong way to put it. But, you know, the sort of sports we don't think of as violent, but it's competition. It's winning. It's, you know, being the top dog, the alpha male, alpha female type of stuff. So I think those are the kinds of ways that maybe in modern society we have tried to deal with it. And obviously some people don't, and they end up doing violent acts.
Yeah, maybe, you know, what's interesting about the paradox you're talking about when it comes to violence is that we now, although we seem to be, we are probably, you know, we are more aware of violent crime and just crime in general because of our complete obsession with the media and with our devices and what have you. It may seem like the problem is bigger than it's ever been, but in fact, we are at the least violent point in human history as far as we know it, you know, in kind of recorded history. You know, that's what the statistics speak to. So although we seem to be confronted by the reality of crime a lot more, we're actually living in a safer society than human beings have ever lived in.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what we're seeing in our own country, I think,
maybe
is also,
not in South Africa.
You know, is when those social controls aren't working properly, I do think that contributes to more violence. I mean, we don't, sad to say it, have great policing anymore in South Africa. There's bits and pieces here and there, good detectives, you know, pockets of excellence. You're going to hit birds and cars, people.
Yeah,
if we
exactly.
don't do that, if we don't include them, you're going
to
never
get
this.
No, we like
podcast.
The lorries. It just to kind of really South Africanizes.
The Hardy Dodge should kick in soon.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if the social mechanisms and structures start to sort of crumble, like we do, are seen in many examples here in South Africa, then I think it just allows stuff to happen that if you had very good policing, very, you know, ordered society, people would kind of fall back in line in a way, naturally. But the minute that starts to fall apart, I think those inner ways of behaving where we start to not follow all the laws, whether it's the laws of driving the car to paying the taxes to this, just kind of like become guidelines which people don't have to abide by.
So maybe I'm going to make the case for like maybe a monthly beheading, public beheading on CNN or something. you know, so we can all get a kind of slake our thirst a little bit on that stuff, if you need to. What I'm interested to understand as we discuss Rater here is how you differentiate between somebody who's consciously deciding, and whether this is the case with him or not, we'll discover. But someone who's consciously deciding to, I'm going to be a killer. I like the idea of killing. And somebody who's driven by just an innate urge.
Mm.
Do you differentiate there? Do you see a... Because one seems like, you know, I want to be a serial killer for the likes. The other one feels a bit more like, this is how the Lord made me.
Well, I think the problem is, the similarity is that both have to be prepared to go and do it.
Yeah.
And other serial murderers will do it and feel bad, but they'll do it again. Other ones will not feel anything and do it again. So I'm almost, in a way, not too worried about whether one's doing it because he just likes the attention, the other's doing it because he's angry with sex workers because if something had happened to him. It's almost, in a way, well, you're all going to be serial murderers. You might just be different kinds of serial murderers with different pathologies. The one might be a psychopath, the other one might not be a psychopath. Mm-hmm. One might be a sadist, one might not be a sadist. But you meet that base rate criteria of two separate murders, you know, you start to land in that category of serial, then what subtype you are is, of course, a different story. The hitman who just gets paid to do it, the person like Moses Attali who gets those urges to get revenge, or anything in between.
This is something I love kind of about the podcast and revealing the reality of the fact that serial killer is a very broad term, isn't it? It's not, maybe we kind of narrow it down to a certain set of typical criteria, you know, like the kind of guy that's, you know, the Ted Bundy type character traits, or the Ed Geins, or that kind of stuff, you know, guys who are sexual sadists and that, you know, the really sick ones that kind of get a lot of mainstream attention, sick in inverted commas. But yeah, so it's interesting to understand all the nuance that kind of lies beneath the moniker serial killer. Let's jump back into the story.
Yes. So, Kyle.
Kyle.
Essentially, it kicks off. And like I said, it was a very short murder to arrest process in this instance, thankfully. So, but essentially, we have sort of towards the middle, toward in about the 19th of, I think 19th or 21st of August, 2019. Essentially, our suspect in this case, Kyle Raters, who I think was about 24 at the time, I think, if I'm not mistaken, essentially is caught in his neighbor, and I say neighbor in the sense that she stayed in the floor of the block of flats above him, in her flat, caught kind of literally with like the rubber gloves on and cleaning up blood when the victim's co-workers and friends realized she didn't come to work and they're very worried about her. And so he's literally caught red-handed because there's blood on his hands and arrested at the scene.
Which would tend to alleviate his need for the use of the term smart serial killer because I think in the serial killer guidebook, high on the list is don't kill the person above you in your block of flats as your first victim.
So again, he tries to explain it away, saying she hired him to clean up the block of flats, her flat for her. They're not buying any of that, etc. So in that sense, it's quick from crime to, I think that was the next day after the incident. So what kind of happened in that instance is that he kind of had been, and this is what we kind of find out later, he'd actually been looking for stalking in the sense of getting information, Google searches, Facebook social media searches, a number of victims, ladies, all of them ladies, gathering information about their movements, where they stay, etc., to target. One of those ladies, of course, was Lynette Forsgenk, who lived above him in the block of flats. And essentially what he originally said his motivation was is that he owed some guy, some drug dealer, 30,000 rand, and he needed to pay him back this money, so he planned to kill someone and rob them, take their valuable items, and then he would be able to pay off his drug debt.
He was a drug user. I mean, this is a relevant point to understand.
Yeah, took and Mandrax and Dacha, etc. around that.
Struggled to hold down jobs. He'd had a couple. He worked at the CUM bookstore in Tiger Valley. He couldn't hold that job down. So he was trying, but clearly battling the disease of addiction.
Yeah, and we can get into sort of more details about his history if, also. Yes. So essentially, 4 o'clock that afternoon, she comes home to her place. She's carrying grocery bags, and he kind of almost watches her, and then as she goes into her flat, he kind of then just basically follows her in and then confronts her, overwhelms her, grabs a knife that was on the kitchen counter, and then just starts to stab her in the neck and in her body. So interestingly, he didn't take a knife with him. He opportunistically took a knife from the scene. That's not so smart. So in one sense, he'd been planning this, thought about it. He knows he's going to kill the person, but he didn't bring the weapon with
him. The act itself is extremely impulsive.
It's almost like, hang on a minute. And you'll see as we go through the next few steps where, again, he's like, does stuff, but he wasn't prepared for what he was going to do. So a mixture of planning, but not actually planning very properly, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a lot of his attention is focused on just identifying a victim as opposed to, okay, what am I going to, and I know who I'd like to kill, what am I going to do when I get into that situation?
Now, people in the block of flats do hear her screaming, apparently, and, they notify the caretaker, maybe you should call security, but nothing happens for some reason. Now, we're not quite sure why. Maybe everybody thought everybody else was doing something, or maybe they knocked on the door, nobody responded, so it's kind of like, well, what do I do? I mean,
South Africans are so renowned for their good neighborliness.
There you go. So then, essentially, accordingly, only thereafter he decides, okay, well, I'm going to have to dispose of this body. So now, again, my question is, if you're just going to rob someone for financial purposes, you need that money, A, you can break into someone's flat when they're not there. If you are so clearly watching their movements, you'll know when they're not there.
No, exactly.
You'll know their typical pattern of every day I go to work at 7:30 and back at 5. You know, so there's no other conclusion I can draw than he wanted to actually kill someone. I even wonder whether this 30,000 rand was just not him giving some kind of excuse that doesn't make him look like a complete psycho killer, to use that terminology. And they'll often do that, try and soften it in some way. You know, oh, the victim was mean to me, or rude to me. You know, kind of like make it sound like there's some reason why, you know, he might have gotten into that situation. So I always question even the 30,000 rand drug debt, because you, there's so many things, ways you can rob people or burgle a place without even there being a victim present.
Yeah.
Robbery, of course, yes, but you don't even have to kill robbery victims. And you've chosen someone who lives in the same block of flats as you. So you know that once you start this, you're going to have to kill them because they know who you are. So the, for me, the murder is something that, that was planned. It was going to happen. He knew that. But apparently he decides to cut her body up. But again, why? You can kill her, take whatever stuff you want, pop downstairs, and whenever the body gets discovered, it's discovered. You can put it in a bath and it'll, you know, last longer or stay fresher for longer before it's even discovered. He decides going to cut her up. Now, we always say that spending lots of time on a crime scene is really dangerous for you as a criminal, because literally, what do you do, as we saw in this case, when people come to the front door and you're standing there with the head in your hand and a saw in your other hand? Or in this case, you've got gloves on and you're cleaning up the blood. So it's incredibly high-risk time period. It's unnecessary in this instance. Because even if you did dispose of the body, you're never going to clean that place properly, that the forensics team aren't going to find blood.
Yeah.
And cleaning up blood takes forever. And cutting up a body takes forever. Yeah. And then having to dispose it piece by piece takes forever.
He actually stopped because he realized that the handsaw he had was inadequate.
Yeah.
And he Googled the trading hours of a local hardware store,
yep,
and then left to go and buy a more suitable implement for saw. So again,
and came back the next day.
A lot of planning on who he's looking at, but not thinking about. I mean, you know, you could have pre-Googled the best saw for sawing up a human body.
Exactly. So, and when he comes back the next day to continue, but and for what for? So it's really like I can't come to any other conclusion that he wanted to do this.
Yeah,
it was so important for him to spend hours doing this, coming back the next day and continuing, because he wanted to.
Yeah.
Not, he didn't have to do it. And again, we always look at it, a crime scene as what was necessary and what was extra.
Yeah.
So if you want to go and rob someone or steal money, you don't have to go there when there's a victim there. You don't have to kill the person. You don't have to choose one that's above in the flat above you where people, the person knows you. You could have done that in multiple ways to get money that wouldn't have put you in that position where you have to kill someone.
Was there any, there was no sexual component here?
Well, again, it's difficult to say.
He
disposed of some of the body parts, of course, outside. I can't help but think that there's a sexual undertone because all the victims he was sourcing were female.
Yes.
Why would that be necessary?
Yes.
Unless you think, well, they're weaker, I said inverted commas, so I can overwhelm them. Well, yes, but again, you don't have to even have a victim because you can check when they're not home.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether it's Arnold Schwarzenegger's house, as long as he's not there, it's not a problem. And if you look then at his diaries, you start to see that he definitely had issues about his sexual prowess and being seen as this ladies man. So I can't help but think there was some underlying sexual,
maybe issue. Some intent to commit a sexual attack initially, but couldn't control the scenario. I mean, again, he's not very prepared for, he doesn't seem to have thought through a lot kind of what to anticipate once the attack begins.
So we have them the next day. When Lynette doesn't arrive at work, her colleagues come and her sister decide to come look for her to check if she's all right. They arrive at the flats and literally find Kyle with yellow hand gloves on, busy cleaning up blood in the passage near her front door. And like, what are you doing here? And they call the cops.
Sure.
So, like I say, he's arrested literally in the flat, blood on his hands. And that's, as I said, when they find parts of her body inside the flat. They found some of her possessions in his flat. So he lived with his aunt, who originally for many years he thought was his mom. And until I think about the age of 18 or 19, he later discovered she actually wasn't his mom. So he kept stuff. I mean, the stuff that they had found, a green scale, keys to a flat, two medicine bottles, a cooler box, you know, not also things that if you're going for money, those aren't things that are going to bring you any money. So again, this trophy, souvenir kind of stuff, etc.
Was he intoxicated at the time?
I would imagine. It wouldn't surprise me if he was. Not that that caused him to do this, but that perhaps gives him the Dutch courage.
Okay.
To be able to do something like this. So a lot of pointless items. You know, he didn't get his 30,000 really. Etc. From this whole robbery. We also then find the investigating officer coming on the scene. So, Warrant Officer Sean Johnson. This apparently was his last case before retirement, I think, or just the court case was the last case that he went to court for his retirement. Initially, Cal doesn't really want to say anything. But again, now I don't know if Johnson had ever been on our training course in SAPS. I mean, we had quite a few people going through our course. And of course, I've been out the police for many years, and he might have had the training. But he just seemed to be the right kind of guy. Because he seemed to have approached Kyle in a certain way that eventually got Kyle to sort of, you know, tell him what happened and open up to him. So again, the right kind of detective with the right mindset. Some people have that naturally. Other people don't, and we have to teach them on our training course. And that's my lovely little dog that mm-hmm. you're hearing barking in the background.
We record the podcast at Gerard's petting zoo at his home.
So they start to find things in his house, you know, books about serial murder. And the more and more I listen to this case, the more and more I think of the Velcom killers. They had books about serial murder. They'd mm-hmm. thought about this, written about it, documented it to some degree beforehand, chopped up the body like the Velcom crowd, etc. So this, in a way, almost is quite a big parallel to some degrees to the Velcom stuff, you know.
That would be the murder of Michael van Eyck.
Yes. You know, then they start to find out that he has these diaries where he's been stalking multiple ladies on social media and otherwise, their movements, etc. 17 other names of women, apparently that he also was on a murder list of his, according to the research. You know, he kind of describes himself, I think in his diary, as the charming psychopath and I'm a clever serial murderer. So he was viewing himself as a serial. So that's why I start to say we have one murder, but this person actually, we need to look at him and in terms of his risk. And this is also what I testified at the Velcom cases. His risk is that of a serial murderer.
Yeah.
He was caught after the first one, but we can't say, oh, well, he's only got one, he's not a serial. Because what you see leading up to it, what was discovered afterwards, but was in the preceding time leading up to the murder, this guy should be dealt with, and his risk profile should be that of a serial murderer.
Would you be less concerned if you spent time with this guy and ended up considering that, you know, he's intellectualizing killing someone as opposed to kind of fulfilling an innate urge?
Mm.
Is there maybe like, does he do it and realize, oh, you know, this is too much trouble, I'm not going to bother anymore, and therefore become less of a risk in the future, maybe.
You know, how would we ever know?
Because it's not like he's got to do it because he needs to...
The thing is, he has done it. So he's already placed himself in a category of, we know what he is capable of doing. So even if he tells you, oh, you know, it wasn't as great as I thought, I'm not going to do it again. I just don't think we can take that as some kind of, oh, okay.
No, I agree in the context of the legal system. Yeah. I'm just asking kind of, just in your opinion...
And
as to how fixable he is. Mm.
Well, that's a good, relevant question because that also touches on his risk. And as we'll see in a moment, he was assessed at Falkenberg prior to the trial, and they found some very important things that would definitely affect his risk profile.
Okay. Let's get there then. What he's done, essentially, is created this story of himself, this fantasy of himself as a serial killer.
Mm.
And it feels like he's then, in order to bring that fantasy in reality, he's now acted upon this narrative that he's created about himself and in relation to himself, and he's now acted upon that in order to solidify this idea that he has.
Yeah, moving from fantasy to reality. So let's look at the stuff that, I mean, I have some choice quotes that I got from his diary. I mean, he would write repeatedly about the list of people that he allegedly had sex with. So he's very behept with himself when he says, I want to have sex with 15 people before this date. But here's some quotes. He writes here, ways police can obtain your DNA without your knowledge. They can offer you a can of soda and can match that on a database. This is a deceptive method.
Mm.
So that's in his own diary. And like there's thousands of pages of diary. I sort of had to quickly scan through it. He writes here, harsh traits, harsh truths about women. Women would rather share a successful man than be attached to a faithful loser. Many women do not marry for love. The innocent girl is usually the horniest and unlikely innocent. Many women consider your looks, career, and what you can offer before good character and integrity. Women in sex desire to be treated as an object and relish in it. So he also goes on to say things like, what I want. I want to have sex with thousands of women. I am the best seducer in the world. I am a magnet for the hottest females. I am a sexual light. I am what women want. Women flock to me. Visualize, and he writes next to that, visualize this every night before bed. So he's very much in this positive affirmation stuff. Almost like he's been reading self-help books, but he's very narcissistic already to start off with. I don't even know if he needs that kind of ego boost. And he writes here, I'm grateful that I am a psychopathic killer.
Well, the books in themselves are immediately making me think of, I mean, when you talk about the thousands of pages and lots of them, I'm immediately taken to the movie Seven. Mm. And the John Doe killer character, serial killer in that movie. And of course, the kind of unmarked diaries that he kept with random thoughts. Writer feels like a bit of a piecemeal serial killer. Like he's taking, when he comes into contact with an aspect of serial murder in his daily life and in his consumption of media, it's all kind of feeding his idea of who he is as this killer.
I mean,
character.
We know he was quite fascinated by Ted Bundy, you know, American serial murderer. But he writes here in his diary, my goals for 2019. So this was the year of the murder, if I recall correctly. Get shredded AF. I'm sure you know what AF means. Have sex with 200 females before the 31st or 32nd of December 2019. I hope it's 31st because 32nd will never happen. Get my own place. Get a motorbike. Make 100,000 Rand by 31 December 2019. Have sex with at least three of the sex slaves on your list. Do at least 10 courses. Have one night stand with a female. Stop porn. That's at least positive.
Travel. And do some courses. I mean, again,
do some courses.
It's a mismatch of some really great stuff.
Yeah. Travel to an overseas country. Learn a new language. Also pretty positive. Try smoke less weed. That's also very positive. So
he's doing great, apart from the chopping up people, murdering and chopping up people ideas.
We're starting to get this impression that this guy's not seen the world in the same way that the rest of us do. And, absolutely. You know, that goes on if you start to look at... So he was sent for observation, as per very common, you know, when before trial, they want to make sure that at the time of the crime, the guy was totally about had his mental faculties and there wasn't a mental health issue affecting his behavior. And also, can we put him on trial? So that's the observation.
That kind of period would be how long?
30 days usually. Okay. Can be made shorter, can be made longer, but a standard is the 30 days.
I'm guessing he's got issues with women.
Yeah. So he's
going to come out of this.
To Falkenberg.
Disruptive women in his childhood.
Yeah. So he's referred to Falkenberg where he has that assessment, and they actually recommend he should come back, if he gets convicted, he should come back for a Section 286 evaluation for dangerous criminal, because that's already, that means they were very, very worried about what they found at that point in time. So he's found fit to stand trial. So again, doesn't mean he's normal, but it just means that no mental health issue was causing him to commit these acts.
Yeah,
he wasn't a guy who heard voices that told him to go kill his upstairs neighbor. And he can be put on trial. He can consult with his lawyer. He knows what's going on around him. He's in touch with reality. So he essentially goes and does plead guilty. He submits a plea where he admits to what happened. So in May 2023, so again, a couple of years down the line after his arrest, he pleads guilty that he planned to kill her and to that he cut up her body, etc., to get rid of it, and that he knew that this was always possibly going to lead to a long prison sentence if he was to get caught. Again, he raises the issue that he's a drug addict and he had to get the 30,000, etc. And this drug dealer threatened him if he didn't get the money, etc. But again, I even question whether that's the truth. It's definitely not the reason for this murder. I can guarantee you that, having read this.
Well,
because
right.
he didn't really benefit anything.
No,
you know?
a tray of, an oven tray doesn't get you 30 grand, does it?
No. So on that same day, obviously, understandably, the plea submitted. The court asked him, is this your plea? Do you abide by what's written here and what you signed? Yes, boom, they find you guilty. End of story. So no witnesses had to come and give evidence. Now, of course, you move on to the sentencing phase. So this is where as I said, Falkenberg had originally said at the first evaluation, we think this guy should be evaluated for Section 286. Now, Section 286 is where you get declared a dangerous criminal, where it means that you are a very huge risk to people's safety.
Now, we often talk about life without parole in South Africa not being a thing.
It doesn't exist.
But this is kind of going there.
Yeah. So the options the court was facing was, because it was a premeditated murder, the Minimum Sentences Act says you should get a life sentence unless there are substantial and compelling circumstances to deviate. So the starting point is pre-med, you're going to get life. And again, as we've said very often in this podcast, if you listen to it frequently, but I'll repeat it again, in South Africa, life is till the day you die. The question is, at what point could you be released on parole with conditions? In other words, you continue to serve your life sentence with that in the community. So nowadays, when you get a life sentence, that point at which you can be considered for parole, not necessarily granted, it's not a right, it's a privilege, is 25 years down the line. We call that your minimum detention period, 25 years. That point, you will start to have parole hearings. If you don't get it, you have to wait for your next parole hearing. If you don't get it, you have to wait for your next one. And if eventually you do get parole, you'll be released in the community with very strict, hopefully, conditions, and you will be monitored. And if you bugger up, they pull you back in to continue serving the remainder of your sentence back in prison until you get parole again. So that's the one option. And almost everybody will get parole on a life sentence. So there's no such thing. It's unconstitutional to have life without parole. Another option, which you don't often see people do, is a Section 286 referral, if I recall correctly, which is dangerous criminal, which basically means that you assess...
286A of the Criminal Procedure Act.
So essentially you want to prove to the court this person is a huge danger to other people. You have to get sent back for evaluation by psychiatrists and psychologists who come back and say, these are the reasons why we think you do qualify. The court considers that, and if the court agrees with it, what the court then does is gives you an indeterminate sentence, which means, for example, they can say, right, Gerard, we've found you're guilty of this murder. There's a 286 sort of process underway. The psychiatric report has been received. I find you a dangerous criminal. I'm going to give you an indeterminate sentence. In 20 years, Gerard, you come back before me or another judge and convince me you've been rehabilitated.
Now, this is similar to, and the reason that you brought up the Michael van Eck murder earlier is because this is a similar sentence that was handed out to the
Chenet
perpetrator there, Chenet. Yeah. Yeah.
So essentially what would happen is, instead of you having a parole hearing by correctional services, you go back to court. And they're literally just like another sentencing process. You got to argue, and the prosecution can argue otherwise. And the judge then decides, okay, Gerard, I think you're rehabilitated. You can be released. Or no, Gerard, I don't think you are, another 10 years. So it's actually, it's in an indeterminate sentence. So you could keep someone much longer than on a life sentence in prison. And it's something that often just doesn't get used a lot by prosecutors. So that was the prosecutor's approach here, which I think was correct, the right one. So let's quickly have a look at what those psychiatrists said.
In this context, because there's clearly a big psychological problem there that they're kind of anticipating, that is kind of motivating the need for this kind of sentence, is there a different psychological regime that the person will be put through? He's not going to a psychiatric institute. I guess I got stuck with some of the old terminology. A psychiatric institute, he's still going to prison.
Yes.
But is there is he treated any differently
from a
treatment point of view?
So, yes, you're quite right. The only way he could end up in a psychiatric hospital is if he was found unfit to stand trial, or at the time of the incident, for example, he had voices that told him committed, he'll go for treatment and then release as opposed to prison. So what we're talking about now is going to get you back into a prison. It's just a question of who's going to be able to give you a parole or release you. In this case, it would only be the judge versus getting a life sentence, which means correctional services would release you. So basically what they kind of said is that...
Well, a parole board of kind of some people picked up on this on the street on the way to the hearing.
People who don't know what they're doing. Yeah. Basically, I'm reading now from the psychiatrist's report for that 286 assessment. He sometimes seems disinterested during the interviews. There are no deficits in attention and concentration. In other words, his disinterest wasn't because he has ADHD, and he had been diagnosed as having ADHD many years before. Okay. So that wasn't the reason why he's disinterested. He gave a good account of himself and his background. His speech and mood was normal. He was average intelligence, no signs or symptoms suggestive of mental illness, which already would have been confirmed at that first observation assessment. His remorse was thought to be superficial. So already we're hearing language that starts to make people think who know what we're talking about of an antisocial personality or stroke psychopath. And the assessment basically did find that he has antisocial personality, which is not the same as a psychopath, but just perhaps for our purposes here, it's the very same kind of thing, same spectrum of problems, and with a higher recidivism score was to reoffend violently. So their recommendations was that Mr. Reuters presents a danger to the physical and mental well-being of others and should be declared a dangerous criminal in, as per Section 286A of the Criminal Procedure Act. From a psychiatric point of view, he has no general remorse for the offense. There's deceitfulness and a pervasive pattern of violating the rights of others, which is kind of like ticking the criteria for, you know, the various diagnoses. And they, again, finalize by saying he has an antisocial personality disorder, a diagnosis which offers a poor prognosis for rehabilitation. Psychopaths and people with antisocial personality typically don't really change. They kind of fizzle out, kind of when they get to their late 50s, early 60s. They're still psychopaths, but they're not as active in wanting to pursue their interests.
They want to play lawn bowls like the rest of us.
And that was the recommendations, and there was two psychiatrists and clinical psychologists who signed this particular report.
She said specifically that any young white woman could reignite his resentment and anger.
Yeah.
Why would she call out white women in particular there?
I'm trying to think whether probably it would be, and I don't know his list of potential victims, I think 17 people, that it might have all been white females, which would then you would say his victim preference profile would be for those individuals. Now, why? I mean, I don't know, et cetera. But now we also have a report that was done, as I said, by the investigative psychology section in the Western Cape by the psychologist who is based there at the time. And kind of had very similar findings. I'm not going to go into all of it, but what's some interesting things that she commented on in her interview. This is now Colonel Kirsten Clark. Mm-hmm. You know, she says here that he enjoys voyeuristic pornography and the sense of manipulation, playing God, was rewarding for him. He enjoyed videos where cameras were hidden in houses and the individuals depicted were unaware. So that sort of control, voyeurism, etc. She kind of comments later on also, let me just jump forward, that being in control was his utmost importance to him. And again, what do we say often serial murders about power and control? And she quotes, is fascinated by intellectual power and manipulation, that he identified strongly with a number of serial killers such as Ted Bundy because they shared common issues with their family of origin. He admired psychopaths because they were able to hurt others and not feel remorse, and he envied them for that ability. So interesting sort of insights that's coming out. And her ultimate finding was, you know, very, very much in line with...
That implies that he feels remorse.
Stated, I guess, but they're not actually experiencing it if you interact. So someone can say, I feel very bad about what I've done, but they're smiling. Or you can see, but from their other behavior and collateral stuff, is actually, no, you don't, actually. You're just manipulating, trying to be manipulative by playing lip service. And ultimately, her findings were kind of more along the sort of narcissistic personality, which is that self-centeredness, which I understand, and the antisocial traits. So again, not too far off with what the psychiatrists and psychologists at Falkenberg found in that Section 286 assessment. But ultimately, the point here is that we have someone who's a huge danger to society. Now, did the judge actually accept that? Judge didn't. The judge felt, and this is what I find a bit difficult to follow, is he said, to deviate from giving you the life sentence, I would have to have substantial and compelling circumstances. And he kind of was almost equating, the only way I can give you this indeterminate sentence as a dangerous criminal if there were substantial and compelling circumstances. But that's not actually the case. You know, Section 286 And the indeterminate sentence is actually worse because you don't know when you're going to be released. At least a life sentence person knows 25 years, that's my first point of something possibly being given parole. Indeterminate, you don't know that because you can get another 10 years after that and more and more. So I don't think I quite agree with the judge that giving them an indeterminate sentence means you had to have substantial and compelling circumstances to deviate from the life sentence. So I do think the better route would have been to make this guy the dangerous criminal. We take the power out of correctional services' hands to give parole. We put it back into the courtroom where it can be more rigorously tested. And it could be extended. And you can sit there for 30 years, whereas life sentence you could get out after 25. So I don't agree with the judge. As I wasn't there in court to hear all the arguments, but that's kind of what we're picking up. I do think he absolutely
this qualifies. This workaround is influenced, though, by that opinion and of that kind of being a way to resolve the issue is based on the fact that you have an extreme lack of faith in the parole system.
Is that LPS?
Fixing the parole system seems to be the obvious solution, doesn't it? But in lieu of that, this is an alternative.
He also stated that he had a kidnapping kit that was found apparently in a Weinberg boys' high school bag, which is where he went to high school, or completed high school. And in that kit, reportedly, contained a hatchet, a long shoelace, and a mask. And he said he was trying to save money so he could travel to Johannesburg to kill his biological mother. And that he had planned to kill Lynette, his actual victim, in a way that was painless and quick and not suffering long. But he wanted to make his biological mother suffer. So that's also, fitting in with...
This guy had planned a whole lot of animosity towards women, that's for sure.
And he was fascinated by forensic sciences and entomology, which is using bugs to determine how long someone's been dead, for example, and pathology. And he was fascinated by the human body, how it works and how it decomposes, and done several online courses, allegedly, in forensics and pathology.
Fascinated, but clearly not applying this to his actual...
And not for the right reasons.
None of this is... How do you square that up to say, oh, he's fascinated, he's educated him on this stuff, and then you look at the fact that he's caught with rubber gloves on and a head in a bag the day after.
Yeah.
So in the apartment.
As we said right in the beginning, a mixture of a lot of intense pre-planning, there's multiple victims, he's researching them on social media and through other means, decides on this victim, but doesn't take a knife with him. So how does he know when he forces his way into the apartment where a knife would be that's handy that he can quickly grab, and afterwards, like we said, he didn't think about having the necessary things to cut up the body to dispose of it. So mixture of a lot of pre-planning, but also a lot of not pre-planning.
Feels like this is kind of like a lot of people who are just fascinated and curious, and they take that that kind of hobby interest a little bit further than most people would.
So let's say he hadn't killed somebody and somehow he got into the attention. Maybe his aunt found these books and phoned the cops. The fascination I don't have a problem with, but where it would start to make me concerned is he started to categorize and stalk victims. That's where he could have done all the other stuff in terms of pre-murder, in terms of the fascination with the books, the courses, but the minute you start to have potential victim list, not just a list of people who are really there, but you've actually started to research them. That's for me where I would say I'm very worried about where this is going. So that's when you step into a realm of I'm actually starting to put this into possible execution of my plan, because I've started to source potential victims.
But you agree that a really smart, organized killer would not go near 99% of the silly mistakes that he made along the way.
I'd like to think, You would not choose someone above...
Well, you wouldn't write anything down for a start, would you? I mean, yes, we know that kind of some of the Rolls-Royce serial killers, the Green River killers of the world and what have you, did keep trophies and what have you, but... very, very hidden in their lives, extremely hidden, extremely well organized in that respect, that they were intentional about getting away with it. It almost feels like surely he would have known he wasn't going to get away with it.
Well, that comes back to when people say, oh, but serial killers want to get caught. And that's kind of like an old sort of theory that floats out around there that a lot of people don't in the world don't really agree. There might be one or two that did want to get caught. I just think people just, it's very different doing it in reality than thinking about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just, maybe they assume, well, like he thought, maybe everything I need will be there. I don't know.
Your dog is great until he bites your kid.
Yeah.
And then...
My dog's never done that before.
And then we put the dog down, don't we?
So why? I don't know. And I mean, I don't know whether we would ever get a straight answer out of him. He might say, well, I didn't plan to kill her. I just planned to go and steal my stuff that I wanted to. So, well, apparently you didn't have a balaclava on, so how is that going to happen?
Yeah, and you've written tons of diaries about stalking women and about...
Being a psychopathic killer.
Exactly, and how you fantasize about this. A psychopath, somebody who has an urge to kill, who gets kind of a deep satisfaction from it, you know, who can orgasm when they're strangling someone. When they go into prison, do they have kind of, what do you call it, like go cold turkey, you know? Do they have withdrawal?
I think those thoughts and fantasies will still be there. I don't think there's any reason what's changed that they would not suddenly be there. The fact that he's killed someone, I'm sorry, I don't, because even if the murder didn't quite go out the way he wanted it to, didn't quite give him exactly what he wanted to do, those fantasies that have been going around for a long time would still be there.
Mm.
He's just out of circulation from the opportunity to act it out, because there's very few females in prison and they're always going to be warders. So I have almost no doubt that those thoughts and fantasies will be bubbling away. And if he had a diary and he's been right, you'd probably find these fantasies are written in those diaries.
Yeah.
So, of course, that again comes back to just one day when he's back out. Because we don't know how to change these guys.
Yeah.
You know, no matter, it's not a case of he needs some Freudian therapy or some this therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. We don't know what makes these guys become serial murderers, so we don't know how to fix them.
Yeah.
So like many serial murderers, good chance he'll be well behaved in prison, not up to trouble, because he wasn't really doing bad stuff besides this anyway, except his drug habit. So he'll probably be a pretty well behaved prisoner. Apparently he is now part of the 28 gang, but I think kind of in the Western Cape, if you're in prison, you probably don't have much of a choice. You kind of almost have to be in a gang, possibly.
But
when he comes out again, that's when he becomes, because his risk will become active, because he'll be out and about and in, with the opportunity to do whatever those fantasies. So they'll be there, the thoughts and ideas and fantasies. They're not going to magically disappear. And that's why, again, his risk will become active when he comes out.
Were he to keep a diary in prison and were to, and it contains this kind of stuff, you know, him expressing his urges and fantasies. Mm. Are prisoners allowed that kind of material? Are they allowed to keep that kind of
material? You're allowed to have a diary. I think in this case, I think correctional services are smart. They will see that this is a problem. Because, you know, how has this guy changed? Is he changing? If he's got this kind of stuff 10, 15 years up in his sentence, or he got a life sentence, so we know the 25 years. I mean, this is definitely stuff that people assessing him for parole. If you're still seeing these fantasies, you've still got this, you've clearly got this risk still. We assume the risk is still there, but now if you've got it written down, so guys, this guy hasn't changed. He still has these ideas and fantasies that caused him to commit that first murder all those years ago. So what's changed in this guy?
All this changes.
There's no regulation that he can't have serial killer books and novels in his thing. But I would see that from a risk perspective of this guy's just continuing with exactly the type of things that fueled him beforehand.
Again, another example of our... I feel like some of our serial killers are just massive underachievers, you know what I mean, compared to the rest of the world. You don't often hear stories in America about serial killers that side who are this bad straight out of the gate. You know, you just hit the ground stumbling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, you know, Kyle really didn't Google the right stuff, did he?
He didn't put it into practice.
No, he didn't. You know, Kyle sounds to me like the kind of guy that majority of that was a wannabe up until the point that he killed someone. Unfortunately, when you actually do go ahead and kill someone, you stop just being a fan of true crime and having a kind of a morbid curiosity about true crime and you become the story, don't you?
Yeah.
What are your kind of key takeouts other than that from this case?
Yes, I mean, for me, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I used to absolutely love.
Totally.
You know, back in SAPS. I think I would have loved this case back then. I love it now because it was a bit different to what we normally see.
Yeah.
So in a way, I find Kyle far more fascinating than, you know, a guy who lured, raped, and killed five women. Because we have this rich, interesting insight into what his thoughts and intentions were.
Yeah.
So he's different in that sense. In a way, perhaps more dangerous because he's a bit smarter, maybe, than your average serial murderer. Although he got caught.
Okay.
I think, in a way, he'd be more dangerous when he comes out because I think he's the kind of guy who could learn and pick up, and he's going to learn in prison. A bit more sophisticated in how he was going about it. We just don't see these guys. Normally, the serial murders we have here will just walk up to a woman in the street and say, you know, do you want a job?
Yeah.
He was putting a little bit more effort into it and thought, and effort even after the kill of the person by wanting to cover the body, although that got him caught. So this is the kind of case that, I really find it fascinating.
The access to all of these types of materials, knowing the diaries that, you know, his kind of behavior prior to as well. And so having access to this insight, like you say, also draws clearer parallels to ourselves, doesn't it? It makes him more relatable because we are understanding more of the realities of kind of his daily life and his and kind of the components that made up his day and what went into kind of motivating him in certain directions. You know, some killers kind of stay in this kind of ghostly, otherworldly kind of subhuman category that we maybe don't relate to as easily as when you have these kinds of things to connect to and go, oh, well, I'm interested in true crime. I'm interested in the thought of what's it feel like to murder someone.
Yeah, and for me, that insights that we get from his diary, which is stuff he probably didn't think anybody's ever going to read.
Or did he?
That we just don't have the opportunity.
Is this not the kind of guy that was writing that thinking, oh man, I can't wait. One day they're going to get their hands on this and they will write books about me.
Who knows, maybe.
Yeah. He strikes me as that kind of guy. Sounds like he's quite the big ego, you know, wanting to like...
definitely thought a lot about himself.
To plow through fields of women as Africa's greatest lover.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jared, as always. I'd really like us, like I say, to tackle some of the Bobert story in the near future. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's something we can do. You've got to get off to a news interview, I know. You've got a live interview now up the road, is it?
Yep.
Okay, well, you get off to do that. Then thank you so much, Jared, for spending some time with us again. Any final thoughts?
Don't kill anybody, please.
Please, at
the very least.
Yeah. Keep your curiosity under wraps. Keep it in the diary. All right. Thank you, Gerard. We'll be back again soon with more episodes. Spread the word about the show. Share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone interested in crime in Africa. You can visit us at youtube.com/C/profiler Africa. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, Google Podcasts, you name it. Just search Profiler Africa. You'll find us there if we're there. Follow us on Instagram at Profiler Africa. Join our Facebook group or drop us an email at profilerafricainfo@gmail.com. Get ready to explore crime scenes, sift through evidence picks, and confront images of perpetrators and victims where we have them. It's been great. We'll be back. Thank you, Gerard. Bye then.
Thank you, everybody.
And rest easy. Look at Gerard off to it. Tapping away already. Busy guy, this one.